This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
The 2345 BDNR or Q train to Atlantic Avenue. The party starts at 8 p.m. and it goes on to 2 a.m., so make sure you get there early to reserve your spot on the dance floor. Everyone is welcome and is free to all. For more info, go to liquidsoundlounge.com. Experience once again why ain't no party like a Liquid Sound Lounge party.
Well, all you party people aren't going to want to miss that one. It's midnight on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. That was a rebroadcast of the evening news before that extremely important message, which means that now, with any luck at all, it's time for this.
Moorish. Orthodox. Radio. Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
Red-tailed hawk performs wings dance high above midtown Manhattan, circles around for one last pass over the park. Got his eye on a fat squirrel down there and a couple of pigeons. They got no place to run, no place to hide. Pale male, he's cool, see, cause his breakfast ain't going nowhere, so he does a loop-to-loop for the tourists in the 6 o'clock news. Got him a penthouse view from the tip top of the food chain, boys. He looks up and down Fifth Avenue and says, God, I love this town. The life goes on down here below. Now there's no Mitchell's ghost on a downtown A-train. He just rides on forever now that the Fulton Fish Market's shut down. He said, they ain't never gonna get that smell out of the water. I don't give a damn how much of that new money they burn. Now Hell's Kitchen's Clinton and the Bowery's no leader. And the East Village is creeping across the Williamsburg Bridge. Hey, whatever happened to Alphabet City? Ain't no place left in this town that a poor boy can go. But life goes on down here below. Now there's no to struggle so. and everywhere. He don't care. But life goes on.
God, I love this town. You know, sometimes you really do feel that way, especially when it's a beautiful, perfectly clear, crisp April day and you're bicycling over the Manhattan Bridge and you just look out over the harbor and you can see forever, see straight over to New Jersey, and you just think to yourself, God, I love this town. Well, you know, Steve Earle, by the way, from his album Washington Square Serenade, and it's kind of funny to hear him in his long-haired country boy twang singing about New York City, but only somebody who intimately knows this town could have written that song down here below. Even if you notice, he did kind of lift the tune to the chorus from Stevie Wonder, right? No harvest moon, do-do-do-do. Right down here below, he did. Anyway, well, you know, I've been away for 2 weeks, and, you know, I sort of have mixed feelings about being back. The way I think all New Yorkers generally have mixed feelings about this city, sort of a love-hate relationship with New York City, I certainly know that I do. Well, in some ways, it's been really good to be back. In other ways, it's been a little bit of a bumpy landing. But, you know, I just looked at the cover of the New York Times this morning and saw those Tibet activists scaling the cables of the Golden Gate Bridge and dropping Free Tibet banners. And I just thought back to what a glorious 2 weeks I had out there in sunny San Francisco Bay Area. And the inimitable and indomitable spirit of that place. So, you know what? In that spirit, let's hear a little bit of music that I brought back from Berkeley. And then we'll do a little bit of talking at you. Got some events to announce and some musings and some rants. But here, taking a very different musical tip from Live at Ashkenaz, Volume 1, Africa. Our good friend, Mo Ali Lech.
abe jamana dem kekele abe jene muso kekele ma abe dina na kekele abe pare mo kekele ma wala hadi ma yakadi
You, Mamadou, opening up with a little music from West Africa and North Africa via Berkeley, California, here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. By the way, did I say that this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade? Which it is at now 12:26 in the morning here on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm Bill Weinberg, just back from the San Francisco Bay Area. Two glorious weeks out there. And this was from a glorious disc that I brought back, Live at Ashkenaz, Volume 1. Ashkenaz being the legendary world music club in Berkeley. It's really just amazing what class acts they get at Ashkenaz. And they've just released this is Volume 1. I guess there's more volumes to come of Live at Ashkenaz, compendium of live performances. Volume 1 is artists from Africa. And, well, let's see. The ones that we opened with were, respectively, all right, first the one we just heard. That was Mamadou and Vanessa from Mali. Mamadou is from the Wassalou people of southern Mali, and he is playing. The instrument that you heard back there is the Ngoni, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, which is a form of the lute, one of the many African variants on the lute, broadly defined, similar to the quora, but larger than the quora. You can want to hear more of his music or find out more about his music, you can check out his website, which is musicmali.com. It's like the name of the country, M-A-L-I, musicmali.com. Mamadou and Vanessa, winners of the 2006 Billboard World Songwriting Contest. And before that, we heard, oh, and by the way, the reason I chose that cut, I mean, everything on this is great, but the reason I chose that cut is because I saw them. I saw Mamadou and Vanessa performing live at Ashkenaz when I was out there and had a wonderful time. So a big shout out to you if you're listening on the internet out there, Mamadou and Vanessa. And before that, we heard Moali Lech, who we have featured performing live in this very studio before, the great songwriter and performer of the Berber or Amazigh people of Algeria, now also living in East Bay, living in Berkeley or I think Albany, actually. Isn't that where Mo told me that he's living these days? And playing the mondol, which is another African variant of the lute, a little bit closer to the European lute, as northern Algeria is a little bit closer to Europe. And that was a song, I believe a traditional song, entitled The Groom, or at least on a traditional motif of the Berber people of Algeria, entitled The Groom, which is on, I believe, Mo's first album, right? He's about to leave for Algeria to record what I believe will be his third album. And if you want to find out more about Mo's music, you can also check him out online at flagoffreedom.com. Flag of Freedom Productions is his own enterprise. Check him out online at flagoffreedom.com. And all of this was recorded, and we'll be dipping back into this disc a little bit later tonight, at Ashkenaz. Once again, the legendary world music club in West Berkeley, which has been there for a long time now. I think that Ashkenaz actually got started way back in the early 70s, if memory serves. Thusly named, because it sort of got started around the whole Jewish folk dance scene, which was all the rage back then in the early 70s. But now, obviously, its repertoire has greatly expanded, and it features music and dance from all over the world and is quite an eclectic cultural institution. So I was really happy to see that Ashkenaz is still thriving. Seems like it's going stronger than ever. Very, very tragically, the founder of Ashkenaz, David Nadel, was senselessly murdered a few years back. And he, in addition to being, a leading cultural light of the world music scene, as the founder of Ashkenaz, was also he was a freedom fighter in his own right and a leading activist in the struggle for People's Park and against the University of California's plans to retake the park and turn it back into, well, initially the idea was a volleyball court. I think ultimately they'd like to turn it into housing or something like that. So, all of these struggles continue. I'll have more to say about all of this as the evening progresses. So, let's see. If you want to find out more about Ashkenaz, well, if you're in Berkeley, you can just hop on over to San Pablo Avenue and Gilman, I believe, is the cross street. Or if you're not in Berkeley, you can just check them out at Ashkenaz.com. And or just go to our website, which is morc.info, and you've got all of the links that you need right there in the entry for tonight's show, morc.info. We are updating the show. We are updating the website with the entry for every show every week now. We've overcome our technical difficulties, and we're back in the saddle. So there's a little entry for tonight's show, as well as the last two shows with Anne-Marie Hendrickson speaking on the gastronomic dilemma in my absence. Thank you, Anne-Marie, for filling in for me. And I believe next week we'll have Anne-Marie back so we can do our long-belated joint show about the politics of vegetarianism. So all of you Anne-Marie fans are definitely going to want to tune in next week. Well, let's see. I opened up talking about, how despite what a wonderful time I had out there in the San Francisco Bay Area, how it felt really good to be back, especially when I was, biking over the Manhattan Bridge and just looking out at the, New York Harbor opening up below me. And I felt just like pale male soaring through the canyons of Manhattan. I was soaring on my bicycle over the East River there. And it felt really good to be back. And then I had a rather unpleasant surprise waiting for me when I got to Brooklyn. And I was just riding along Atlantic Avenue, and all of a sudden I started to get my tire started to lose air. So I dragged my bicycle over to a bike shop because I needed to get to work to get my, tire fixed. And the guy says, you've got a staple in your tire. And he shows me all of the other staples that he had pulled out of other people's tires. And says, you came over the Manhattan Bridge, didn't you? And I said, how did you know? And he says, well, all these staples that I pulled out of other people's tires, they all came over the Manhattan Bridge. So there is some anti-bicycle vigilante out there who is taking the law into his own hands and is sabotaging random bicyclists by giving them flat tires, by putting staples on the... Well, see, here's the thing, is that technically speaking, the bicyclists aren't supposed to ride on the catwalk on the south side, only on the north side. It's supposed to be just for pedestrians on the south side and just for bicyclists on the north side. But, that kind of gives the bicyclist a raw deal because it's much more pleasant on the south side. Now, it's pleasant on the north side, too, but it's on, but you're looking up the river. Whereas when you're riding on the south side, you get a much better view. You can see the whole harbor opening up in front of you, and you can see the Statue of Liberty, and you can see sheer across Staten Island to New Jersey on a clear day, and you can see the Verrazano Bridge off in the distance, and it's a much more inspiring view. In addition, you can see the clock in the Jehovah Witnesses building, the Watchtower building, to the south in Oakland, so you know what time it is. And sometimes it's really important to know what time it is, right? So, a lot of bicyclists actually do ride on the pedestrian side of the bridge. Now, Bob Dylan says that to live outside the law, you must be honest. And, I agree with that. The thing is, if you're going to live by the ethic that, rules are for fools, you've got to show that you're above the rules in an ethical sense and be respectful and not, terrorize pedestrians. And I never do. I'm a respectful bicyclist. I never do terrorize pedestrians. And I have never in any way even inconvenienced, much less terrorized, a pedestrian by riding on the South Catwalk of the Manhattan Bridge. But, maybe I can surmise that that's what happened, that some antisocial jerk of a bicyclist, ran over somebody's Yorkshire Terrier or something on the South Catwalk of the Manhattan Bridge, and the dog owner, or else just some random antisocial pedestrian jerk decided that he was going to be an anti-bicyclist vigilante and sort of go Bernie Getz on the bicyclists, and instead of being out there with his pistol, he's out there with out there with staples, putting staples on the catwalk, on the south catwalk of the Manhattan Bridge, giving random bicyclists flat tires. Okay, now this is not kosher. It really isn't. So, you know, I mean, I appeal to all of my fellow bicyclists out there that, you know, you've got to give respect to get respect. So, you know, please be careful that you don't run over anybody's Yorkie, okay? But on the other hand, I really want to, if you're listening tonight, whoever you are, who has been, you know, giving random bicyclists flat tires on the South Catwalk on the Manhattan Bridge, you know, that's really, really not kosher. That's not a cool thing to do, okay? You really messed up my day, and I never did anything to hurt you or any other pedestrian, okay? So that's really, really not cool, okay? That's not the way to respond to the problem, if, in fact, there is a problem. Maybe there's no problem. Maybe you're just a jerk. Anyway, so, you know, but that's a real New York thing, you know? It's a real New York thing, isn't it? I mean, and one thing I will say is that, you know, San Francisco Bay Area's got amazing infrastructure for bicyclists, especially East Bay has got amazing infrastructure for bicyclists, wonderful bike trails all over the place. And, you know, there isn't this whole sort of, I'm not even quite sure why exactly, but there isn't this whole sort of, you know, Darwinian struggle for public space going on between, you know, this sort of three-way contest between bicyclists, pedestrians, and motorists, you know, overwhelmingly motorists that you've got here in New York City, which just, you know, turns getting from point A to point B into an ugly, aggressive contest, you know. All right, so on the subject of transit, I get off the plane at JFK, and I try to get onto the subway. I swipe with my Metro card, which I've still got my Metro card left over, you know, in my pocket from 2 weeks earlier. So I swipe with my Metro card, and it doesn't let me in. And I'm like, okay, what's up with that? I know I've got something on this Metro card. And it turns out that I only had $1 left on the Metro card. Now, how is this possible? Okay, I'll tell you how it's possible. You see, the thing is that I always get $10 Metro card. And the reason I do this is because, you know, the way it used to be until very recently is you would get $12 for your 10. In other words, you would get 6 rides. So, and then, you know, you throw the card away and you don't like leave electronic traces of everywhere that you go for Big Brother to, you know, conveniently observe. Okay, call me paranoid. You're paranoid, Weinberg. Okay, I admit it. I'm paranoid. But, you know, that's just the way I want to live my life. Okay, you got a problem with it? So, but you can't do that anymore. Because they've, you know, since the most recent fare hike on the subway, the way it now works is that you pay your $10 for a Metro card, and you get, instead of getting $12 worth, in other words, 6 rides, you get $11 worth. Now, if you notice, 11 is not divisible by 2. And a subway ride still costs $2. So this is their weird way of sneaking in a fare hike, thinking that you're not going to notice. But what this actually does is that it means that, you know, if you pay $10 for a Metro card, you know, you're always going to be left with that one extra dollar on your card. I mean, even if you're going to, okay, I would just assume that they would, like, you know, just get rid of the discount altogether and just give you an even 5 rides for your $10 instead of 5.5 rides. You know, what is the point of that except to inconvenience us? I mean, they should at least make it, you know, a sum which is divisible by 2 so that you can throw out your Metro card and buy a new one without being stuck having to recycle the same Metro card over and over and over again. It almost makes me think that it's some insidious conspiracy to keep the citizenry hooked on a single Metro card so that Big Brother can watch our every move. Am I paranoid? Okay, maybe I'm paranoid. But in any event, you know, it's just, I'm sorry, I find it maddening. I really do. Why can't they just, you know, make it divisible by 2? It's only logical, right? So I'm really convinced that whoever it is who runs the MTA, you know, there's a special office in the MTA of people who, you know, get paid to sit around all day thinking of ways to make New Yorkers' lives more difficult. I'm sure that there must be, and they must be getting paid very well because they're very, very good at it. So, I don't know about this being back in New York business, you know. I mean, the city, and I also noticed that the skyscraper, okay, it's going to be like, what, 10 stories or something, big multiplex theater complex slash condominium monstrosity that they've been threatening to build directly across the street from where I live. Well, they've actually broken ground. They actually broke ground on it while I was out there in the Bay Area. They broke ground on the monstrosity they want to build directly across the street from where I live, which means that, you know, once again, I'm going to wake up in the morning and it's going to be for the first, 6 months while they're putting it up, it's going to be, noise and dust and congestion and all that sort of thing. And then when they finally build it, well, you know, there's not going to be any sunlight on my street anymore, right? It's going to be completely darkened by this monstrosity that they're building. But much, much more to the point is that, it's going to further change the entire class nature of the East Village where I live. And I'm going to feel more and more, me and the few remaining people in my building and on my block who are rent-controlled or rent-stabilized tenants, it feels more and more with each passing year like we're complete anachronisms and there's just no place for us in the city anymore. And I do hope that rent control sticks around for a while so us anachronisms can stick around for a while, too. And, just as the balance of power up in Albany was actually going to change and it looked like the Democrats were going to get control of the Senate, well, the whole Spitzer scandal happened and knocked that out of the water, unfortunately. So the balance of power remains what it is, not favorable to the forces of rent control up there, but perhaps not favorable to a complete immediate repeal either anytime in the foreseeable future. At least I hope not. And California, being the schizophrenic place that it is, politically schizophrenic place that it is, they've actually got an initiative on the ballot in June which would overturn rent control statewide in the guise of property rights and fighting eminent domain. So all my friends out there in California who are listening tonight, remember to vote no on 98, okay? Save your own skins. Vote no on 98, yes on 99, which was I haven't gotten mixed up, right? It's no on 98, yes on 99. Maybe if I'm confused, one of our California listeners will call in later and correct me. I think that's it. The Forces of Progress came in and introduced a new ballot initiative which would preserve rent control while protecting properties from eminent domain. That's Initiative 99 as opposed to Initiative 98. So there you go. Here we are back in New York City. And why did I go out to California in the first place? Well, for starters, the ostensible reason for my trip was to do my usual song and dance, my presentation on my pet activist crusade at the moment, which is building solidarity for the Iraqi civil resistance. I did this presentation at the Niebel Proctor Library, which also is called the Institute for the Critical Study of Society, on Telegraph Avenue in North Oakland. And a big shout out to my friends there, particularly my good friends Lou and Rachel, who actually held a square dance at the Niebel Proctor Library to raise money for my airfare and then hosted me for the 2 weeks I was out there and put up with me cursing at my computer late at night. So thank you so much, Lou and Rachel. And thanks to everybody at the Niebel Proctor Marxist Library. Interesting stuff happening out there. Let's see. Who the hell are Niebel and Proctor? Well, according to their website, which is MarxistLibr.org, LIBR, short for library, Carl Niebel was a professor of economics who escaped from Nazi Germany and taught for the rest of his life in various North American universities. His last post was at San Jose State. Professor Niebel died in April 1985, leaving his library to be made available to the public. He wanted his library to be named after his wife, Elizabeth Hale Neeble, who was a leading figure in public housing in the days of the New Deal. The Neeble collection was stored for 2 years until we found a home for it in Berkeley's historic Finnish Hall. So the Neeble Proctor Library had apparently once been a Finnish Hall, a community center for the Finnish community out there in Oakland. And we moved it in January 1987 with 253 cartons of books. Shortly thereafter, we inherited the books and papers of Roscoe Proctor, teacher, labor organizer, African-American activist. Hence the name Neeble Proctor Library. In 1996, we moved into our own building. Also, they moved out of the Finnish Hall and into their current digs at 6501 Telegraph Avenue in Oakland, California. And, okay, so I did my speaking gig about the Iraqi civil resistance there and showed the video produced by our comrades in Japan, entitled Go Forward, Iraq Freedom Congress. Somewhat stilted name, perhaps, but very informative video. And very well received. I actually got a rather enthusiastic response, which was very heartening, despite the fact that it was held at 10 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, which is pretty harsh if you ask me, but it was actually well attended and got a very favorable reaction, very enthusiastic reaction. So I was very happy about that. I wasn't so happy about the fist fight that broke out, but you know, the wingnut factor, what can I tell you? But actually, it was just a small fist fight and nobody got hurt. So, and by the way, just to, I have lots of announcements coming up, but I'll just remind people that tonight was the Anarchist Forum here in New York City at the Living Theater on Clinton Street in the Lower East Side. And I'm going to be doing my presentation once again and showing the video once again on the Anarchist Civil Resistance, 1 month from tonight, the second Tuesday of May, which is going to be May 13th. So I'll announce this again, mark your calendar now, on Tuesday, May 13th, I am going to be speaking and showing the video once again, 7 o'clock p.m. At the Anarchist Forum at the Living Theater on Clinton Street. I can't remember exactly what the address is. Is this it? One hopes for this is it. Let's see. You know, they on the Living Theater's own film series pamphlet, they don't even give the address of the Living Theater. I guess they want you to go online and find it. Living Theater, spelled the English way, R-E rather than E-R, livingtheater.org. But anyway, it's on, you can't miss it. It's on the west side of Clinton Street between Houston and Stanton. That's exactly where it is, right in the middle of the block. You can't miss it. So once again, on May 13th, mark your calendar now, I'm once again going to be doing the same presentation about the Iraqi civil resistance, which is labor unions, women's organizations, student organizations, neighborhood assemblies, etc., who are organizing to oppose both the occupation of Iraq as well as the sectarian militias. Very, very important, heroic work, which not enough people in the anti-war movement in this country know about, so hope to see people there. So that was the ostensible purpose of my trip, was to do that presentation. But I stuck around for 2 weeks. And went to a whole bunch of other events, including there was a very interesting forum on council communism at the Neeble Proctor Library, at which I got up to speed on, among other things, the 1946 Oakland General Strike, about which I knew nothing, I confess. It was sort of, you know, the last gasp of that wave of of big, you know, citywide general strikes on the West Coast, which began with Seattle in 1919 and continued in San Francisco in 1934. Those are the big ones that you hear a lot about. But there was also a general strike in Oakland in December of 1946, which began when it actually began with a strike in a retail store. And when the Oakland police were escorting in truckloads of scabs, the people just on their way to work on Telegraph Avenue spontaneously started protesting, and word spread, and the city was shut down beginning December 3rd, 1946. The city was shut down for like 3 days, entirely shut down. Pretty amazing story. And one of the speakers at the event at the Neville Proctor Library sort of pointed to that. You know, that happened on Telegraph Avenue in downtown Oakland is where that strike began. And then he sort of drew a very interesting juxtaposition between that and the Berkeley Free Speech Movement of 1963, which, of course, began on campus at UC Berkeley, right up at the other end of Telegraph Avenue, where, you know, students started demanding their right to agitate on campus to about the issues of civil rights and solidarity with labor struggles and et cetera, which really kicked off the whole campus movement of the 1960s. So the folks at the Neville Proctor Library have got a good sense of regional history and the sense of, you know, keeping these struggles alive. And those were sort of the two, at least for the one person who made this historical analogy. Those were sort of at opposite ends of Telegraph Avenue and sort of, you know, the last gasp of the old left and the first gasp of the new left. And now hopefully we've got a little bit of, you know, perspective now a couple of generations later, and we're sort of trying to bring it all together. And on the subject of that, another one of the reasons that I went out there was to attend the 13th annual San Francisco Book Fair. Hard to believe they've actually been doing it out there for San Francisco Anarchist Book Fair. 13th annual San Francisco Anarchist Book Fair. Hard to believe that they've actually been doing it out there for 13 consecutive years, and quite the scene. But I am proud to announce that here's the big announcement, folks. Proud to announce that we are this year here in this weekend here in New York City at Judson Memorial Church in Greenwich Village. We are going to be doing the second annual New York Anarchist Book Fair. And let me see, where is the, I thought I had called up the website. Where is the website for the Anarchist Book Fair? I'm so sure I had called it up. Okay, bear with me, folks, bear with me. You know, I've got too many pages open. That's the problem. I got to start closing pages. Okay. All right. Anyway, it's going to be happening. While I'm calling up the website, I should be more prepared than this. I'm just going to say that it's happening this this Saturday at Judson Memorial Church, which is on Washington Square South. I believe it's at the corner of, Washington Square South at the corner of, okay, here we go. New York City Anarchist Book Fair. Here we go. Okay, Judson Memorial Church is, they don't even tell you the address. Okay, what's going to be going on at the, here we go. Thompson Street. Yes, between Thompson and Sullivan, precisely. Judson Memorial Church is located on the south side of Washington Square Park between Thompson and Sullivan Streets. And all day on Saturday, this coming Saturday, April 12th, there are going to be, there's going to be book tables and forums and discussions happening, you should definitely check it out. Let's see, there's going to be a forum on at 2:30 in the afternoon entitled Anarchism is the Only Hope. Lessons from the Derrida Column of the Spanish Civil War. Well, it sounds historically didactic, if perhaps a tad dogmatic. And let's see, on being a girl in an activist boys club. Oh, my goodness. The Radical Homosexual Agenda. Let's see, a report on Christiana, the self-governing squatter neighborhood in Copenhagen, Denmark. Anti-authoritarian mutual aid and radical social work. Building a movement against capitalism through thinking of its alternatives. Anarchy in the USA, the love-hate relationship with presidential elections. Feel the Burn, Conflict Transformation and Healing the Movement. Anarchism in Palestine, oh, I'll bet the sparks are going to fly at that one. Hope there aren't going to be any fistfights. Anyway, you're definitely going to want to check it out. This Saturday, April 12th, at Judson Memorial Church, which once again is at Washington Square South between Thompson and Sullivan Streets. It's going to be happening all day. It's going to be happening from 11 in the morning all the way through 6 o'clock in the evening. So check it out. And there's also going to be an Anarchist Film Festival, the 2008 New York City Anarchist Film Festival, which is going to be happening this weekend as well. And it's going to be featuring some of the final footage shot by Brad Will in the streets of Oaxaca in the moments before his death. There's actually going to be Brad Will's, you know, final footage. So this is it's going to be in honor, as it was last year, in honor of Brad Will. And this year it's going to actually be showing some of the footage which Brad Will gave his life for when he was gunned down by the police in the streets of Oaxaca, Mexico, in on October 27th of 2006. So let's see, where is this going to be? This is going to be this Friday, April 11th, from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Bowery Poetry Club, which is at 308 Bowery near Bleecker Street. And then it's going to be resuming at 6 p.m. at the Yippie Museum, which is at 9 Bleecker Street, a place which has got a lot of, shall we say, history. Good old 9 Bleecker Street. 6 p.m. to midnight at the Yippie Museum at 9 Bleecker Street. So if you want more information about all of this, please go to anarchistbookfair.net. You can read all about it, the New York City Anarchist Book Fair and New York City Anarchist Film Festival, at anarchistbookfair.net. What else are they going to be showing at the film festival? Let's see. Dozens of short documentaries and experimental political videos by radical artists and activists from around the world. So, you know, be there. Be there. By all means, be there. I will certainly be there. Check out the second annual New York Anarchist Book Fair. So, you know, San Francisco has now got a, let's see, what is 13 minus 2? It usually tends to be 11. San Francisco has got an 11-year head start on us, so we got to, like, you know, make up for lost times. Everybody show up at Judson Memorial Church on Saturday for the Anarchist Book Fair, and show up on Friday during the day at the Bowery Poetry Club, and then in the evening at the Yippie Museum at 9 Bleecker Street for the New York City Anarchist Film Festival. Yeah. So let's see. Now it's 1 o'clock in the morning on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City, where we're going to be hosting the second annual New York City Anarchist Book Fair this weekend. My name is Bill Weinberg. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and we've got another half an hour. So let's see. You know what? Maybe we'll take another short musical break, and then maybe I'll spew a little bit more about my love-hate relationship with New York City, and I guess I also have a love-hate relationship with the San Francisco Bay Area, you know? Because, you know, this was actually, I haven't been out there since the year 2000. No, 2001. It was just before 9/11. It was like weeks before 9/11 was the last time I was in the San Francisco Bay Area. So this has been the, you know, partially due to having hit economic hard times post 9/11, like a lot of people did. This has been the longest stretch. By far the longest stretch I've ever gone without going out to San Francisco since I went out there for the first time in 1981 when I was a sort of an anarchist vagabond. And boy, does that ever make me feel old. 1981, my goodness. So, and you know, every time I go out there, I sort of have this feeling of, my goodness, what a magical place. Maybe I'd be happier if I lived out there. But then I remember that, you know, I tried that in the early 1980s and I came running back to New York because, I just couldn't adjust ultimately to the fact that, well, you know, everything shuts down at midnight in East Bay and everything shuts down in, at 2 o'clock in the morning in San Francisco. And, you know, everything is kind of slower out there and everybody's more polite and friendly. And, you know, I'm kind of a grouch and I'm very fast paced and I just didn't feel like I fit in, you know? So, I guess I kind of have a love hate relationship with San Francisco too. So, and you know, also it's like the weather. One of the reasons that I went out there in the first place was to get away from the New York City winters, which really, really bring me down. And boy, am I happy that spring is coming. But you know, what I found is that out there, people, you know, here in New York City, because we really do, or we used to, before global warming hit in, we used to actually have harsh winters and, you know, snow and sleet and, you know, temperatures down in the lower teens or even lower. People understand we live in a temperate climate and, you know, you've got to like, you know, heat the buildings and you know, get dressed warmly and so on. Out there in the Bay Area, they think it's like sunny California. And because, you know, it never does actually snow out there, they think they don't recognize that they're living in a temperate climate. In fact, it really does get quite cold. Remember what Mark Twain said? The coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in San Francisco. So consequently, you know, none of the houses are at least sufficiently heated. And even though it never gets bitter cold out there, you know, it gets cold enough that you just never quite warm up. And it's kind of like this damp cold that really sinks into your bones. We get a damp cold in New York City, too, but it's damper out there. So I don't know. You know, I don't know what I'm going to do. I mean, the thing is, when I came running back to New York after 3 years of living more or less continuously in the San Francisco Bay Area back in the early 80s, it was a very nomadic period of my life. But if I called any place home, it was there for about 3 years there. I came running back to New York, and it was the New York of Ed Koch in the mid-1980s, and the Tompkins Square scene, and there was really a sense of social struggle going on, even though it was very dark and apocalyptic in a lot of ways, you know, the homeless crisis and the AIDS crisis and, you know, the beginnings of the gentrification being enforced by police brutality. But, you know, now it's like, you know, it's 20 years later, 25 years later, and I just feel like, you know, okay, we've lost. The social struggles are over, and we lost. And, like, you know, me and my friends who've still got, you know, rent-controlled apartments are just like, you know, this anachronism. And sooner or later, there isn't going to be any place left for us in this town. So, I don't know. I don't know where else I would go. I really don't know where else I would go. Maybe, especially if John McCain is elected, maybe I'll just leave the country. Maybe I'll just relocate to Nicaragua. I don't know. I really don't know, you know. But I grew up in this town. This is the only place where I've ever felt truly at home. So I really don't know. On the subject of Tompkins Square Park, before we cut to some music, I'm going to say that some of us aging veterans of the Tompkins Square struggle, and particularly of the Tompkins Square police riot of August 6th, 1988, we held a sort of a reunion on the steps of City Hall on, Thursday, I believe it was, April 3rd, to protest the fact that they are putting surveillance cameras in Tompkins Square Park, which is just going to kind of, you know, be the final nail in the coffin of, you know, everything which we've been through and the whole, you know, struggle over keeping the park as some kind of liberated zone and more generally keeping the Lower East Side as some kind of liberated zone, you know, even if only for, you know, a part of the city where there's a little bit more elbow room for freedom than in many other parts of the city. So, you know, I mean, now, you know, a lot of people have been forced out. Some of the squats have been evicted. Some of them have survived and gone legal, which is good. But, I still, the Lower East Side is just, you know, it's changed almost unrecognizably. And, you know, people today, like, you know, the young reporter from New York Press who showed up and covered the press conference, I wondered, did she even know that, you know, there had ever been a Tompkins Square riot before this press conference was called? Did she even know that there was a band shell in the park before the city destroyed it in the big backlash of 1991? A band shell where Richie Havens and the Grateful Dead and countless, you know, local salsa and punk and reggae bands had played over the years. You know, did she even know? Do the young people who are moving into the neighborhood today even know? So the big struggle now is, are we going to get a permit for the 20th anniversary, commemoration concert of the Tompkins Square riot, which is going to be held the first weekend in August. And we certainly do hope that we're going to get the permit. So stay tuned. We'll certainly be following that one very, very closely. Okay, so here we are in New York City, and I'm not sure if there's any place left here for us crusty old dinosaurs. You know, and once again, if they put the surveillance cameras in Tompkins Square Park, that's really going to feel like that's one of the last nails in the coffin. And I'm really going to feel like, my God, you know, I've got to leave this place. And I've always said that if they get rid of, Katz's Delicatessen, that's also going to be like, okay, you know, the cultural extermination of old New York is now complete. I've got to get out of here. And, of course, if they ever finally do away with rent control, I'm not going to have any choice. I'm going to have to leave. And finally, you know, if WBAI ever goes under, you know, that's really going to be it. I'm just going to feel like it's curtains for New York City if WBAI ever folds. So all of you people who pledged in the last marathon, please do pay your pledge. We're going to be having another marathon this coming up in May. I promise you we're going to do some good programming in spite of having to harangue you for bread. So please do, if you're not a member of BAI, please avail yourself of the opportunity in the upcoming marathon next month and become a member of WBAI, no matter how much you disagree with a lot of what you hear over the airwaves at this place. And God knows I disagree with plenty that I hear over the airwaves of WBAI. It's really, really important to support this institution, because you never miss your water until the well runs dry. And at least WBAI affords us the opportunity to say, ouch, as capitalism continues to clobber us over the head on a daily basis. So with that, let's avail ourselves of the free airwaves of WBAI right now to hear another cut from Live at Ashkenaz, Volume 1, Africa.
ويخيبون ويخيبون الزمان Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. Salama. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. Salama. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. Salama. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. What you need is peace and love. What you need is peace and love. What you need is peace and love.
More music from Live at Ashkenaz, Volume 1, Africa. That was an artist named Nawal, a song called Salama. Obviously starts out in a very sort of Islamic motif and ends up sort of riffing off of Bob Marley. And this artist, Nawal Mianau, is from the Comoros, of all places. So I'd like to know more about him. Or is it her? Forgive me. Haven't checked out the website yet, but it's nawali.com. N-A-W-A-L-I.com. I'll have to check it out later. And by the way, did you happen to notice that there was a failed coup d'etat in the Comoros this week? It happened so fast that I didn't even have time to blog about it. So don't go to WorldWar4Report.com. You won't find anything about Comoros. Maybe I'll find the time tomorrow to see what the hell just happened. Can anybody tell me what the hell just happened in Comoros? It was just a military uprising there, which was apparently unsuccessful, put down. But I'd sure love to know what that was all about. Anyway, so once again, we'll be hearing more from Live at Ashkenaz, Volume 1, Africa. You can check out Ashkenaz online at ashkenaz.com. And let's see, what else? We've got just around 10 minutes left, so maybe I should keep on going, talking about my trip to the San Francisco Bay Area. So let's see, what else did I do on my exciting trip to the San Francisco Bay Area? Okay, I'm going through some... Where are my notes here? Where are my notes? Oh, here we are. Okay, so there was another, after the San Francisco Anarchist Book Fair, there was another anarchist event held on campus at UC Berkeley entitled The Bastard. Can I say that on the radio? The Berkeley Anarchist Students of Theory and Research and Development. The 8th Annual Bastard Conference. And that was interesting. The sort of the star of the Bastard, the leading light of the Bastard, was Ian Boll. And what was he talking about again? Let's see. My old friend Mitchell Halberstadt was also there. Where is the entry for Ian Bowles' workshop? Mitchell, Lawrence, Wolfie, Sabrina, John B. Oh, come on. Well, it's here somewhere. Anyway, you know what? The reason I have to look up his entry is because I don't even remember what he was talking about, because maybe it went over my head. Yeah, let's put it that way. I think it went over my head. That must be it. But what I actually found much more interesting was the presentation by the Anarchist Outdoor Theater Troupe of Thiel Eulenspiegel at the Easter of the Sap. And the synopsis reads, how did the lumpen loser Eulenspiegel, a.k.a. Owlglass, transform himself from thief and con man to insurgent against church and state? In this case, the Spanish Empire and Inquisition. A rebel without a clue, he seeks the aid of Lucifer. And, this is apparently all based on a 19th century Flemish novel entitled Thiel Eulenspiegel by Charles de Coster, presumably a Frenchman, which concerns the follies and foibles and sort of unintentional heroism, I suppose, of Thiel Eulenspiegel, who's sort of in the great tradition of the wise fool or the savant hero or the autistic hero, I suppose. And it's set against the backdrop of the revolutionary struggle of the Flemish people against the Habsburg Empire in the 16th century. And in this particular tale, which was produced as a play by the Outdoor Anarchist Players, Thiel Eulenspiegel is he sort of undergoes a sort of induction ritual by the spirits of the spring. And in fact, Lucifer is not Lucifer the devil, but Lucifer the angel of light and the spirit of the coming spring, who empowers Eulenspiegel to carry on the struggle. So a very good one for the coming of the spring. Indeed. So that was interesting. Let's see. I still can't find Ian Bowles' blurb here. My goodness. Oh, yeah, here we go. Ian Bowles is an Irish social historian of science and technics and a professor at UC Berkeley. And he was speaking about anarchism and the priesthoods of knowledge. Ian Bowles asked whether Kropotkin's legacy of scientific anarchism has anything to offer in an epoch of secular, not to mention religious, dogmatism under conditions of spectacle. Sounds really important. I wish I had understood a goddamn word he was saying. So, let's see. Okay, there was the Eulenspiegel thing, and there was the bastard, which, once again, is the Berkeley Anarchist Students of Theory and Research and Development, the 8th Annual Bastard. And what else did I do out there? Let's see. What else did I do? Oh, yeah, right. Also on campus there at UC Berkeley, there is a tree sit which is going on. Apparently there's, believe it or not, threatened oak trees, which were planted as a war memorial to San Francisco Bay Area residents who lost their lives in the First World War, planted back in the aftermath of the First World War, are now threatened. The university wants to cut them down to build a sports training facility. And for almost 500, yet count them, 500 days now, there has been a tree sit. It hasn't been the same people up in the tree for 500 days, but there has been somebody continuously occupying these oak trees on campus at UC Berkeley for almost 500 days. We're up to like 590 days or something now. When I was out there, I think it was 586 days. So it's quite extraordinary. And this is not their – they've taken on numerous issues, including not only that the trees be preserved, but community input into UC's development plans what is it, Raspberry Canyon, I believe, or is it Strawberry Canyon, which is where the Memorial Stadium, where they want to cut down the trees, is located, and also where UC wants to build a BP. You know, they're calling themselves Beyond Petroleum, but that's really a scam. It's actually still British Petroleum. A BP biofuels laboratory and a nanotech laboratory and other such monstrosities. So, and also, of course, they want an end to University of California involvement in nuclear weapons research and development. So, you know, every Sunday at 2 p.m., they have a big vigil down below the trees at the Memorial Oak Grove on campus at UC Berkeley. So if you're in the Bay Area, hop on over there. UC Berkeley Memorial Oak Grove Tree Sit above campus. Actually, it's on campus, but it's like above the campus proper in the stadium, which is still UC land. I guess it's part of the campus. On Piedmont, just north of Bancroft, every Sunday at 2 p.m., join the tree sitters, cheer them on, and one hopes that they will prevail in their struggle. And I just found out, by the way, I didn't even know when I was out there, but I just found out from perusing some of the literature that I brought back that there's also a tree sit going on at UC Santa Cruz. I'm not sure if it's been going on for quite 500 days or, what is it, 800 days? Whatever I just said. But for quite some days now, there's been, I think probably weeks or months, there's also been a tree sit happening at UC Santa Cruz in similar circumstances, where the university wants to cut down some trees to put up some monstrosity, and people are sitting in the trees to prevent them from doing so. So quite amazing, quite amazing. Okay, of course, people who are following the news know that the Olympic torch has just arrived in the San Francisco Bay Area. So the Tibetans were out there marching pretty much continuously the whole time that I was out there. They were every day at around noon in front of Civic Center in San Francisco, and every evening at around 7 in downtown Berkeley, the Tibetans were marching. And today, of course, people who saw the front cover of the New York Times, there were big protests in San Francisco when the Olympic torch actually arrived, and people actually hung Free Tibet banners off the cables of the Golden Gate Bridge. So one hopes that the Tibetans will be prevailing in their struggle. And right on to all their supporters in the San Francisco Bay Area who came out to cheer them on. Amazing, you know, there's really an amazing sense of local radical history in the Bay Area. One of the things that really impresses me about the place, everywhere you go in San Francisco, there are murals. And, you know, you walk around the Mission and there's murals of, you know, depicting the Mexican Revolution and the Ohlone Indians and how they lived in the Bay Area before Europeans arrived. And you walk around Chinatown and there's murals of the Chinese railway workers from back in the 19th century and so on, and a real sense of ethnic pride and historical memory. And let's see, one day my friends took me up to a place called Indian Rock. It's one of those places I don't even want to talk about because I don't want it to be overrun by by tourists, because it's a really beautiful little place. But I guess everybody knows about it. It's a place up in North Berkeley with these big, huge rocks of rhyolite, whatever that is. It looks very much like granite, but it's apparently North Bray rhyolite with these amazing views of the entire bay. And I was hanging up there. I was hanging out up there on top of the on top of Indian Rock, you know, watching the view. And these guys behind me were speaking in a Mayan language, and it was the same Mayan language that I had heard just a few days earlier on some young punk-type kids who were talking on the BART, and which is the Bay Area Rapid Transit, their version of the subway. And I asked them, ¿Ustedes son de Guatemala? And they said, no, Mexico. And I said, ¿cuál parte de México? And
please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.